Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce William Rivers Pitt. He is author of three books, and his latest is House of Ill Repute, Reflections on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation, with an introduction by Cindy Sheehan, and it's published by Polypoint Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're a news gatherer, a political analyst. You've written these three books. You're a regular contributor to the news site truthout.org, which I've been reading for years. How did you leave your job teaching English to start all of this?
On a wing and a prayer, essentially. I had been writing and doing a lot of analysis work while teaching, and after a time, especially after my Iraq book came out, it became simply too... It was on the edge of becoming unfair to my students for me to be spending as much time as I needed to dealing with the books and the politics and the war. So I walked away from the teaching aspect and basically ate ramen until I could get my feet under me as a writer.
Now, in your very first book, considerably before the invasion of Iraq, you exposed that Iraq didn't have any weapons of mass destruction.
It was a book that I wrote along with Scott Ritter. It came out about 7 months before the invasion, back in the fall of 2002. It was called War on Iraq. It kind of makes me want to tear my teeth out. The book said flat out that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, no Al-Qaeda connections in Iraq, no reasons to go to war there. And that book has been, every one of these anniversaries that passes, the book continues to be borne out as having been completely accurate, and it's intensely frustrating to even think about.
And we actually interviewed Scott Ritter on this show a number of times, and he's a real truth teller.
Yep.
In one of your essays, I found this very interesting. You challenged the idea that the war in Iraq is a study in massive incompetence, which seems to be what a lot of people are saying. Your perspective is that what happened there is precisely intentional rather than incompetent. Explain what you mean.
Well, the essay you're thinking of, I think, is a chapter in the book called Incompetent Design. And the argument that I put forth in that is, in the run-up to the midterms, you heard from every Democratic candidate about the astonishing incompetence of Rumsfeld, of Bush, of Cheney, of all the rest of them, in allowing this to have become the thing that it became. But that leaves out the oft-neglected fact that when these fellows decided to invade and occupy Iraq, their ultimate goal was to create a permanent military presence there. This was a plan and a desire among these people well before they even got into this particular administration. So the idea that all of the stuff that feeds the argument which says we can't stay because it'll be a mess does in fact fulfill the ultimate desire that they had at the outset, which is we're not going anywhere. There's all this conversation in politics these days about withdrawal. When do we withdraw? Do we even bother? Can we? Will we? Should we? How do we do it? The only people in America who aren't talking about this are the folks in the White House because they have no interest in it. And the messier things get over there, the more difficult things get over there, the more difficult it is to come up with a coherent plan for that withdrawal, which serves the ultimate purposes of the whole process in the first place. So I'm not entirely sold on the idea that it's all incompetence. I think it feeds the arguments that staying is the only recourse, which is what they ultimately wanted to do in the first place.
And the information that that's what they ultimately wanted to do in the first place is borne out by the PNAC.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's a project. It's a think tank that initially came out of the folks over at the American Enterprise Institute. The Project for New American Century, and this all sounds like something out of a Robert Ludlum novel, except for the fact that they have a website, and you can go and read about this stuff yourself. This particular think tank included Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, a number of the other leaders of the foreign policy wing of this administration, and in 2000 they came out with their chief white paper, their main argument, their main, you know, reason for being. It was a document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And in it, they established their desire for all of the things that have since taken place. invade Iraq, establish a permanent military presence there, and attempt to overthrow regimes, friendly and unfriendly alike, all across the region, along with throwing considerably more billions and trillions of dollars from the gross national product into the Pentagon's budget. Now, they haven't quite gotten around to knocking off regimes left and right over there, but the fact that they are so unwilling to do anything other than stay over there, and the fact that we keep hearing all of this snarling towards Iran, means that they have not even come close to letting go of that particular desire.
There's another aspect to all of this, which is a very great shift in the role of the federal government. So, I mean, you talk and you write in one of these essays about the previous role of federal government included things like social services, pensions, keeping the air clean, and so on. That's pretty much all down the tubes, and that's part of the big picture that you're looking at.
Well, truly. I mean, you're talking about a group of individuals within this government who adhere to, and it's, you know, there's a lot of it that's nonsense. I can't, you know, name for me, please, a small government right-wing conservative administration that has actually shrunk the federal government. They haven't existed.
Right.
But it's a lot of talk. They shrink aspects of the federal government, like social services, drug programs, police programs, anti-crime programs, pollution and environmental control programs. They got the budget, public education, they got the budgets for those, and sling them into the, you know, Star Wars during the Reagan administration, building thousands of missiles during the Reagan administration, across the board military ramp up in this administration. So they're, one of their great spokespeople was this gentleman named Grover Norquist, who is an anti-tax crusader from way back. His famous line was, I don't want to destroy the federal government. I just want to shrink it down to the size where it can be drowned in a bathtub. When you gut the federal government's ability to take care of its own people, you wind up with New Orleans drowned in the bathtub. And it stands worth mentioning that the Army Corps of Engineers down there, responsible for taking care of those levees, had $71 million gutted out of their annual budget in 1 year alone. That money was taken and sent to Iraq to fund the occupation. So it isn't so much they're shrinking government, it's just denuding anything that might actually help real people to send billions and trillions of tax dollars into the folks who are actually this administration's constituents, the defense industry, the oil guys, and all, you know, ancillary connected industries that, because we're on a permanent wartime economic footing since 1946 and the establishment of the Truman Doctrine, makes the preparation for and fighting of wars as much a part of our economic indices as housing statistics and consumer confidence.
In addition to sending money to Iraq, which is by, at this point, many people's estimation in this country a fool's errand, it's not just sending it to Iraq, it's sending it to these contractors such as Halliburton and Blackwater and so on.
Sure, this money doesn't disappear. Somebody is always getting paid.
And it's not the soldiers.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. They can't even get a Band-Aid, unfortunately. I have a friend, a young kid, who since he was 14 years old had wanted to be a soldier and specifically a Marine, and had gotten himself into one of the best private military schools, colleges in the country. And midway through his sophomore year, as all of this stuff was unfolding and he was watching Iraq and all of the rest of this foolishness unfold, he decided that these people and this whole situation were not worthy of the commitment of his life to it all, so he quit. And a few weeks after he quit, comes all of these stories about Walter Reed and the disaster that was going on there, which is only the tip of the iceberg of the disaster that's going on throughout the entire veterans health care system. So you go over to Iraq based on a bunch of lies. You don't get any body armor. Most of the guys you know have gotten killed have done so running defensive caravans up along the roads between Tikrit and Mosul and down to Baghdad to guard the oil shipments and the oil machinery that's going back and forth there. They're the ones. An IED isn't going to kill a guy going door to door. Most of these guys are getting killed by the side of the road running defense for the oil trucks. Don't get any armor in your vehicles. Something happens to you. Then you come home and you wind up in a veterans medical system that is just as stripped of funding as the Army Corps of Engineers trying to keep the levees together with spit and baling wire. So he, unfortunately for us as a society, made the right decision. And I use this kid as a sort of a personal example of why and how things have gone so wrong. Someone like that who is convinced and decides not to go and serve their country in a way that they wanted to do since they were a kid tells you a whole hell of a lot about how bad things have gotten.
It's amazing that in that example that somebody would give up really their heart's desire and the kind of profession that they were meant for. What did he decide to do instead?
He doesn't know yet. He's trying to figure it out. He spent about 6 months here in Boston flipping burgers and trying to get his head out of the fact that the plan that he'd had for years had kind of fallen apart because he made a very courageous decision to completely change direction. Now he's just trying to figure out what to do with himself.
We're talking to William Rivers Pitt. Now, you've traveled all across the country. You've been speaking to people all over the place. You've been listening to what they have to say. And there's this sort of cliche in the media that our country is terribly polarized. I don't know if it's a cliche or not. How true is it? What have you seen on the ground when you talk to people?
Not very. Not very. The best political conversations I have tend to be with Republicans because you find out people walk around thinking, God, it's so polarized. It's so polarized. They meet someone who's of a different political stripe. And I've been convinced by all the pundit talking head people that there's someone I have to fight with. At the end of the conversation, we wind up agreeing about much more than we had to disagree about. At this point, arguing about the merits of Social Security is almost quaint compared to the things that we actually agree with. Most of the Republicans that I know, a lot of the Republicans that I have met, spit when they hear the name George W. Bush. They figured out a while ago they got sold a bill of goods on this guy. You think that the liberal progressive community is angry? Go meet a Republican. Who's got their head on straight in terms of knowing what the actual facts are, knowing what is best for the country, and you'll meet someone who is volcanic in their anger. So I don't know. I don't necessarily buy into the idea. It's less that we're polarized and more that we become polarized because it makes for good television, and it definitely keeps people tap dancing along.
Well, that's something that I wonder, because the media seem to really thrive on conflict and telling stories of conflict, which may not really be accurate at all.
I don't think they're accurate in any sense. You want to talk about it. Everybody talks about how dangerous it is to have such a polarized country. You want real danger for the folks who have caused all this stuff or allowed it to happen? Wait till the people who are supposedly polarized start holding hands and walking in one direction, and that's when the walls are going to start coming down.
Well, that's an interesting question, because in the introduction to your book, House of Ill Repute, Cindy Sheehan says something along the lines of, the current regime is crumbling like a stale cookie. Now, she wrote that nearly a year ago. It still hasn't crumbled.
It won't crumble. It'll never entirely crumble for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is the one sector of the Republican Party that'll never abandon these guys are the same 25% that keep his poll ratings hovering in that, you know, tepid place that it's been for the better part of a year now. These guys won't crumble. What they are is paralyzed. They can't even fire U.S. attorneys without having the whole world come down on their shoulders. So, and I, you know, I don't want necessarily to endure the kind of constitutional mayhem that will come if an entire branch of the federal government just, you know, rolls over and dies. I like the fact that they're paralyzed because they can cause a hell of a lot less trouble.
There's a historical point that you mention in your book that is relevant to the big questions of Iraq and the oil companies and so on, which I think a lot of people know little or nothing about, namely the series of court decisions that granted the United States corporation the status of a human being with all the attendant rights and safeguards. Tell us about that.
Well, it was 1886, I believe. The court case was Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad. It was a pretty straightforward eminent domain case. Towards the end of the actual decision, the Supreme Court, which at that time was entirely packed with railroad corporation lawyers, decided that corporations deserve to have 14th Amendment rights. Now, the 14th Amendment is really nothing more or less than an encapsulation of every other right that had come before it. But we have now corporate persons. We have entities with the same rights and privileges as natural human beings. as soon as this was ratified by the next Supreme Court, court case that used this as precedent, it became locked in. Now, the history of the country was that before all of this unfolded, corporations were incredibly distrusted and very, very, very closely watched. When the guys threw the tea into the harbor here in my town, they weren't no so much rebelling against the British Empire as they were rebelling against the East India Tea Company and the Mass Bay Tea Companies and the corporations flying under the British flag that were the strong right economic arm of British rule at the time. From then, after the end of the revolution for another 100 years, a corporation was chartered by a state, could be disbanded if it even slightly got outside of its charter, could not buy any other corporations, and could not participate in the political process. As soon as these 14th Amendment rights were granted by the Santa Clara case, how do you deny a natural person the right to buy into another corporation or to participate in the political process? And now we're off to the races. And slowly but surely, as these corporations became more and more powerful, they began to not only participate in the political process, but dominate it. This was capped off by the, I believe it was 1976, Buckley v. Vallejo Supreme Court case, which said that unlimited campaign spending, fundraising and gifting by corporations and by individuals amounts to free speech. This was the enshrinement of what I came to call super citizens, with all the people with the entities, corporations with the same rights and privileges as a natural human being, but with about 10 million times more power to push their desires out into the political realm. And it is the long and short, in my opinion, of a lot of the problems that we're dealing with today.
I mean, this is the system under which we live, and it's not clear to what extent people are really aware of that, not to mention aware of its history.
Most people aren't, and most people are equally unaware. And you think about this situation long enough, and you realize that quite a lot of the things that we tend to bang around, who do you vote for, who do you not vote for, which party is good, which party is bad, has a tendency to be window dressing, because these super citizens that we've created have managed over the course of, ever since that first decision, and especially over the last 30 or 40 years, to rewire the entire system to benefit them. When the third aspect of it is something that I mentioned before, when you have the Truman Doctrine establishing a permanent wartime economic footing, which exists to this day, that was one of the most empowering moments for the very small segment of the economy, being the defense and petroleum industries, getting this Mississippi River of taxpayer money into them, which has made them more powerful, even as their own power was what got that done in the first place. So you cannot overestimate the degree to which the system itself no longer caters to very much more than the industry. I mean, more than any other aspect of what government is supposed to do, these people are always taken care of. They get the lion's share of public money, and they are the ones who, you'll never meet them, you never voted for them. They've bought and packaged virtually the entire federal government, and that government is not going to do anything to disrupt that particular flow.
So,
and a lot of it comes right back again to the fact that about 100 years or so ago, they wound up being given the rights of natural persons. And it has so much to do with the problems that we have today.
So a harsh reading of this is that the United States citizens pay their taxes. A lot of corporate oil giants really don't pay their taxes. They do creative accounting so as not to have to pay very much of it. But then the war in Iraq actually ends up giving them control of another country's oil. Is that what we actually have in Iraq now? Do Western-owned, U.S.-owned oil companies have control of or have access to Iraqi oil?
Oh, absolutely. Not only that, but you factor in the couple trillion dollar surplus that came out of the Clinton administration. That's gone now, and it didn't just disappear. Somebody got paid, you know. Somebody's always getting paid. That money got sucked up as soon as they could get their hands on it. A lot of it went to those tax cuts. 42% of the tax cuts go to the 1%. The rest of it has been flushed down into the defense and petroleum industries. And when they got over there, for several years after they got there, the country, being Iraq, with the second largest proven stores of petroleum in the world had gas lines that made our gas lines in the 70s look quaint by comparison, because the people, these companies that got control of the oil heads weren't pumping the stuff, they were sitting on it. Now they've passed this privatization of the oil industry over there, which means they can sell it. It's a beautiful little, they get paid, and then they get paid for getting paid. And this is the, you know, remember back in the day they said that the oil revenues would pay for the war. Now it's not paying for the war, but somebody's getting paid.
We're talking to William Rivers Pitt, author of House of Ill Repute.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. Last Saturday night, I was at the Wild Horse Saloon in Nashville. Well, Harry's Roadside was a little crowded, so we just kept driving south. No, there was a wedding we had to go to in Chattanooga, so we flew into Nashville. Okay, so we're walking around the district, the honky-tonk district. We were told not to miss the Wild Horse Saloon. We walk in, and it's enormous, a huge dance floor. The joint is crowded with tourists. Okay, so we have come in for the barbecue spare ribs. There's four of us at a table, and the ribs are sensational. We would like to communicate this to each other, but we can only gesture by holding a rib in one hand and smacking our lips, because the sound system is wall-to-wall blasting out country rock with attitude. Assaulting is not a strong enough word. And no, it's not just because we get the senior citizen discount. I saw a young couple in there, and the entire evening they never said a word to each other. It could have been their first date. How do you get to know one another? In my day, whatever day that was, we had sparkling, witty, scintillating conversation. Today, I guess they just let the music talk for them.
I'll go quietly. I'll go silently, but I'll go crazy without you, insane with a heart so blue, they'll have to lock me away, and I won't last one day without you, baby, I'll go crazy.
So who needs scintillating? I'll talk to you next week if you have a minute.
I never thought I'd see the day.
You know, we talk a lot on community radio about the failure of the mainstream or the corporate media to get at real news, the kind that you're talking about now. I mean, I'm sure some of our listeners are saying, now hang on, where did he get that information? What are some of the stories that you think are most important to tell? How do you make sure that they are airtight and verified? What are some of the stories that you're telling that the corporate media aren't telling?
Well, there are two aspects of the media you have to be aware of. I read somewhere between 20 and 30 newspapers a day. I talk to a lot of the people who are involved. I talk to the people who have been over there, who are going over there, who have been working in these particular industries. Read enough of the mainstream print media, and you can figure out what's going on, as long as you recognize certain names to be to avoid, like, you know, Miss Judy Miller and folks of her ilk. But if you read enough of the printed news reports out there, you can get a good idea of what's going on. On top of speaking to the players yourself, it's the television media that has absolutely and comprehensively failed the American people. And why this is so troubling is because the vast majority of Americans get their news from the television. They don't have the time to do what I do and read 20 newspapers a day. That's why Truth Out is so important, because we take that and we distill that reading down to a few stories that people can wrap their hands around every day. There was a really marvelous moment on MSNBC this morning. They're doing a all-day-long report on the four-year anniversary, and there was one of their sort of main political talking head people on one side of the screen and Chris Dodd on the other side of the screen, and Chris Dodd is doing a fantastic job of talking about, oh, it's a disaster in Iraq, it's a mess, it's this and that, and he makes an allusion to how they cooked the intelligence and basically lied to everybody. And the media woman says, well, you know, that's all well and good, but we need to make sure that we're talking about the future. And he agrees right away, yes, we need to talk about the future, da-da-da-da-da. These guys would rather light themselves on fire than have any discussion about how they themselves either allowed this to happen, empowered it, or just blew it completely. And it's both the supposed good guys up there in Congress and our friends on television who 3 or 4 years ago it was, well, everybody knows that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And now it's, well, everybody knows that wasn't true. No discussion whatsoever of the great why in between. You know, it's just, well, everybody knows X and then everybody knows Y. I'd like to have a nice long conversation with the TV people and a few of our senators and House members about Z, about the big hole in the middle of that. Because without a discussion of why this happened, there can be no real way to solve it, because we're dealing with the same people who basically caused this whole mess in the first place.
I think also, I mean, when you say, oh, why look at the past? Let's just look toward the future. Suppose you said that during a murder trial. Oh, why dwell on that murder? Let's build a better world. I mean, you have to look at the past.
There's no getting around it, because you're dealing with, like I said, you're dealing with the people who caused this stuff the last time. To blow off what happened for some pie-in-the-sky attempt at a solution to the future, while allowing the same people who pulled this thing off in the first place to remain in place without any accountability, you're polishing the brass on the Titanic.
Now, you've put your full life energy into the work you do at some personal cost, and you spent all this energy working with Scott Ritter, trying to prevent the invasion of Iraq, educating the people. Many others were involved in that work, too. How do you handle what seems like continual defeat and non-listening?
I watch baseball. I watch football. I gift myself the opportunity every once in a while to unplug my brain from all this stuff, because if I don't, I'd be out firebombing. Actually, that's a joke, but not really. What I do generally, I made up my mind a long time ago, and I'm no radical, for the love of God, you know. 50 years ago, they'd be calling me a conservative if I was a member of the Democratic Party. But I made up my mind that a lot of the things that I would like to see happen, I just decided that I'm not going to see these things in my lifetime, even if I live to be 100. Once I was able to really convince myself of that, then the job becomes to push as hard as I can, to move the pile as much as possible, to do my own part on the hope and the faith that someday at some point it will have added at least a little bit of energy to repairing what has been done. And this isn't all the Bush administration's fault by any stretch of the imagination. When we're talking about Supreme Court cases in 1886, we're talking about an enormous tree that we have to chop down in order to fix this thing. So it doesn't begin with them. It sure isn't going to end with them. And it is just a day-to-day effort to try to live up to all of the potential and all of the other people who have spent their lives defending the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all of the hope and excellence that is embodied in that, if we can keep it out of the hands of greedy little hustlers like George.
One of the things I hear in your work, and I hear this a lot, is a frustration with the American public for not getting off their duffs and doing more than they do in the face of the horrors that we're facing. And yet I also see at the same time a lot of the avenues for protest and dissent are really stymied. In other words, we do not have access to the mainstream media, particularly the TV, as you say. Community radio is an oasis in the middle of that. You know, the administration doesn't listen to the will of the people. They pretty much ignore mass demonstrations. What do you think are the effective avenues for protest?
Well, first of all, I don't get frustrated at the American people. I see within liberal and progressive circles online, but also in conversation, words like sheeple bandied about to describe the majority of the American people, and it makes me want to scream. I find that a vile word. There's an old computer term, GIGO, G-I-G-O, garbage in, garbage out. If people who are dancing as fast as they can just to pay their mortgages, keep their kids healthy, afford health care, don't have the time to read 20 newspapers a day, the best they can do is watch the TV show, sit down on Sunday with the talk shows, maybe read one newspaper. Garbage in, garbage out. And this is not a modern phenomenon. People have been solemnly walking into voting booths and voting against their own best interests for decades now. That's just part of the problem. In terms of how to bring about change in this particular situation, I also think that the majority, because of this and for a variety of other reasons, cannot always be depended on, unfortunately, to get it right the first time or the second time or the third time. It was Margaret Mead who said, never forget that a small, determined group of people can change the world. It's the only thing that ever has. So I think what the progressive community has been doing has been effective. It just takes a long time. You have to burn through so much noise and so many lies and so many preconceived, embedded perceptions in order to get there. But the last midterms are a fair example that if enough energy and time and dedication and information is put out there, it can move the pile.
You know, an underreported George W. Bush activity that you've written about, and I wanted you to talk about this a little bit, is this phenomenon of the signing statement. What are these signing statements, and how does the president make use of them?
Well, if the legislative branch passes a law, say, like, for example, you can't use the NSA to wiretap on American citizens, George and the boys can have a great big old wonderful signing ceremony and sign the thing and say, yep, that's a law, and then they attach a memo to it that he signs also, which is the signing statement, saying anything even vaguely referencing a law or any kind of binding legal rule that was in that last legislation is null and void if I say so. It's a way for this administration to, it's like a line item veto in reverse. The line item was there in the process of making bills. This is a line item veto after the bill is done. And a lot of it is the supremacy of the unitary executive concept that's actually Dick Cheney's bread and butter. Cheney was one who lived through the Watergate situation, saw the executive branch lessened, the power of Congress and the media made greater, and wanted more than anything else to reverse that. And signing statements are a nifty way to do it.
There's a great essay in your book about a conversation you have with the bouncer at the pub that you frequent in Boston.
Yep.
And tell us a little bit about that. I mean, you know, it said to me a lot about A, what people don't know, and B, the extent to which people are open-minded and willing to change on the basis of more information.
Well, if somebody trusts you not to BS them and you have the information at your disposal, you can really change people's mind. The bouncer is this great big sort of Republican right-wing guy, pulls me aside one day and asks me about the Patriot Act, which then turned into a conversation about the NSA wiretapping, which turned into all the rest of it, and just basically letting him know where things stand in terms of Section 213 of the Patriot Act, which lets him come into your house without ever showing you a warrant, the NSA wiretapping thing, blowing past the FISA law in the FISA court, which is the easiest court in the history of the world to get a favorable ruling from. This is one of the reasons why I'm not terribly upset whenever anything I do has to be what you describe as preaching to the choir, which is letting people who are already on your side know what the facts are. I mean, the easy answer to that is you have to preach to the choir because that's how you get them to sing. But the much more pertinent part of that is you arm people with information and facts and send them out into the populace and have conversations like this, you can change minds. You can absolutely reverse somebody's deeply held beliefs, especially if that person is one who considers himself a Republican, considers themselves a small government person, does not want these guys peeking through windows or listening on the telephone. It all comes back to one of the oldest, I mean, I don't remember exactly who said it or where I read it, but every single significant social movement in history began with a conversation. So that essay is a neat kind of snapshot of the truth of that idea.
The content of the conversation you had with him, I think, is worth talking about a little bit. And the law of the land as we have it today allows basically George Bush to come into your house and wiretap your telephone, look into your computer, and so on, without any court's approval and without you ever knowing. Is that true?
The court's approval thing is not quite accurate. A judge does have to sign off on the thing, although these more recent stories about the FBI and their federal letters, which is no judge has anything to say about it. It's the because I said so power granted to the FBI. A judge does have to sign off on a warrant, but back in the good old days, if they were going to come into your house, they'd hand you a warrant. You knew they had been there. This, it's specifically Section 213 of the Patriot Act, which legal scholars have dubbed the sneak and peek provision, allows them to come in, tap your phone, go through your stuff, put a program on your computer that not only gives them access to all of it, but will record and then broadcast every keystroke you make. They can do this without ever letting you know they were there. These people could have been in and out of my house 100 times in the last 4 years, and I'd have no idea. And if you go and you take even a cursory read through the amendments to the Constitution, that's pretty much safety and home, person, and thought right out the window.
Now, you write about Christian fundamentalism and compare it to other forms of fundamentalism. What are the differences and similarities between the kind of extreme fundamentalism we have in the U.S. and, say, Islamic fundamentalism?
Well, beyond the religious underpinnings, the not whole vast difference between every religion has its Taliban wing. Yitzhak Rabin was shot in the back by a member of the Taliban wing of Judaism. We have guys like Fred Phelps protesting at soldiers' funerals here in America because he's a member of the Taliban wing of Christianity. And then, of course, we've got the Wahhabist folks coming out of Saudi Arabia. And it bears noting that Saudi Arabia's state religion is Wahhabism, the hardest of the hardcore. Every religion has its own Taliban wing. And the way you create extremism in any society is through deprivation and ignorance. If you feed people, if you teach them, if you give them some sort of inlet into the economic lifeblood of whatever country they live in, you give them a chance to do better, or at least for their children to do better than you have, the amount of extremism, no matter what religion, will dry up and blow away. It's not, no religion has cornered the market on extremism. It comes from lack of access to opportunity, lack of hope, and lack of information and education. A period, end of sentence. If we can figure out how to fix that, and it's really not that huge a fix, we will take care of radical religious extremism very, very shortly.
We're talking to William Rivers Pitt, author of House of Ill Repute. How did you meet Cindy Sheehan and come to work with her?
I was writing about her son before she ever got into politics, and she and I started up before she ever got into activism, and we started up an email correspondence that lasted quite a while, and then she had done a few things before she went down to Crawford, Texas, and did that sit-in in front of the ranch, at which point I went down and spent some time with her and truth out, stayed down there for the entire duration. That is essentially how I got started with her.
Let's talk for a moment about community radio, because this is the time of our semi-annual fund drive. Why should listeners call now and support public radio?
Because it is a place where information that isn't bought and paid for can be exchanged. The free exchange of ideas is the whole point of the exercise. You go on to MSNBC or NBC for two examples. You're watching a network owned by General Electric, one of the largest defense contractors in the world, which has its own massive budget of opinion as to what's good and what's bad, not necessarily for us, but for their bottom line and their stockholders. Your community radio is a place where average people can speak to average people on the issues that affect them every day without having to worry about, well, who's writing the checks? What does this mean to me? Where's the bias coming in? And not just political bias, but more importantly, political bias is a tiny little ant compared to the kind of economic ownership bias that comes into a lot of other, and radio is no better in terms of, you know, Clear Channel and all of the other large corporations that own most of the radio stations out there in the world. If people need a reason to support community radio, let me give them a website. Wait a second so you can grab a pen. It is a website run by the Columbia Journalism Review. So you're going to go to www.c as in Charlie, j as in Jeffrey, r as in Ralph.org, and then the slash, and then the word owners, cjr.org/owners. What that is the Columbia Journalism Review's break down an overview of who owns what in the mainstream media. And if you go and click on General Electric, if you go and click on AOL Time Warner, if you go and click on the News Corporation, and you see the degree to which a very, very small number of people own virtually the whole shooting match, that in and of itself is the best argument I can think of for why community radio is vital.
And KSFR, of course, is a small, independent, nonprofit entity here in Santa Fe. And I wanted to tell you that our news director, Bill Dupuis, recently wrote a memo instituting a policy that we were not going to use any stories off the wire that cited anonymous high government sources.
Well, then you're probably not going to get very many news stories to use, are you?
Well, we've got plenty, but that policy has actually itself made news all over the place because not a lot of people have actually done that as a policy.
Well, there was, what was it? It was MSNBC who tried, or the Associated Press, who tried for a week to not report on Anna Nicole Smith. And the fact that they chose to do that for a few days also made news, which is both amusing and sickening. But yeah, that's a good thing because it's the anonymous sources that put rumor and innuendo out there, and it's a lack of accountability for the people who are reporting, who can use these anonymous sources as a means of making sure that they can keep their high-flying connections with the White House or whomever intact. We saw a lot of this unspool during the Scooter Libby trial, when guys like Russert had to get up and be shown as being nothing more than water carriers for folks like Rove and Libby and the rest of them, and are more interested in making sure that their telephone calls get returned than in reporting anything of any degree of accuracy or holding anybody to account. Once upon a time, the motto of journalism was to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. That is now no longer the case.
Tell us more about truthout.org. That's actually a site that I check every day.
It started right after the 2000 election, and it's an organization that essentially is a news distillation service. As I said, all the editors read 20, 30 newspapers a day. We try to peel off 10, 12, 14 stories a day that from all over the world that we think people need to know. It also has, nowadays, over the last couple of years, a large body of original reporting and original writing, which is excellent. We've got a series of film crews going out and doing documentaries and doing on-scene reports of different events, protests, hearings, and whatnot. And it's just a great place. If you want to wrap your arms around the enormous budget of news that's out there, a lot of it is worthwhile, but don't have the time to read that much, Truth Out is an excellent resource.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us here on KSFR.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking to William Rivers Pitt, author of House of Ill Repute. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and we are podcasting. You can find us at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can send me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.